This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
It's certainly possible to say that our human situation is not so good. And from one point of view, each of us as a span of life with its share of joys and sorrows. Sometimes the mix isn't quite what we would choose. And then this lifespan is sort of framed by mystery. During this lifespan, sometimes we search for meaning. I've talked about this before. You know, there's even a book, "Man's Search for Meaning," as though somehow women didn't search for meaning too. The Buddha sort of seems to have taken a slightly different tack. Actually, a very different tack in some ways. And in fact, he saw that if there's the sense of a person searching for meaning, may not go so well. From Shakyamuni Buddha's point of view, so-called meaning is inseparably bound up with the person who searches. Therefore, it's not so constructive to put it outside somewhere and then go looking for it. Because that will obscure the fact that the person who searches is itself a mystery. And that the span of life may appear to frame our existence, but it does not confine it. So Shakyamuni shared these teachings with us, and after a while, some people were enthusiastic enough about it that they felt like, well, we should, everybody should have access to this. All beings who are in the same existential situation should be offered the opportunity for freedom. So they came up with the Bodhisattva vow. Which is to say, even if one could once and for all vacate human existence, that we wouldn't do that. In fact, we would keep arranging for rebirth so that we could be available to other beings to tell them about liberation. Last night I was reading some W.H. Auden poems, and I ran across that famous line of his, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. And somebody commented that that seemed kind of bleak. He said, well, yeah, we all know about that situation. But in that quote, I heard some echo of the Bodhisattva vow. So that the main concern isn't constantly circling back to this, but is constantly turning outward. Kind of a puzzle whether, you know, is there such a thing as equal affection? I'm not sure how we'd figure that out, even. So let the more loving ones be us. In the face of our human situation, that, you know, might be rather a challenge. I sometimes depend on the New Yorker magazine for Dharma Talk material, and the recent issue, a recent issue, has a cartoon of some guy who's waking up in the morning, and sitting on his windowsill is the so-called the bluebird of nothingness. And the bluebird of nothingness is reciting its little act, which consists of saying things like, there is no essential self, and the universe is silent, and human life is absurd. I suppose this is the opposite of the bluebird of happiness, which presumably says things like, yeah, there's a self, and human life is great, and so forth. But I think if a Buddhist looks at that cartoon, a Buddhist might think, actually, that sounds pretty good. You know, kind of, this is the sound of liberation is in what the little bluebird is chattering about. That there is no essential self is a wide open door. And the silence of the universe is a profoundly peaceful. And the Zen people, they could probably even be okay with human life is absurd. Okay, it's all right, it's not a problem. So to find our seat in the midst of this at times awkward and painful human life is what practice is all about. And eventually the liberating quality of that practice becomes available to others. Without our, making a big show about it. Sometimes practice will strike us as quite difficult, other times quite easy. And eventually we notice that the power of the vow is such that it carries us through all of those impressions of, oh, practice is hard, or oh, practice is easy. Without letting us get pulled off the path like a horse, stopping to nibble on something while you're trying to get somewhere. Of course, we're not really trying to get somewhere. And the horse and the rider are one. This is a little difficult to get our minds around. So first and foremost, our practice is rooted in the body-mind. It has an intellectual aspect, but that's definitely, it's not subordinated exactly. It's always within the ambit of the body. Otherwise we can get very, very, very kind of tied up in essentially not that important Buddhist doctrines. A lot of Buddhist hair splitting is not much better than any other kind of hair splitting. So you want to avoid that. And in Zen, of course, they too noticed that practice is kind of difficult, and Buddhist teaching is a little bit difficult to get your head around in a way that actually affects your life. I encountered Buddhism when I was in high school, and I was pretty excited about it, but it was a couple of years before I began to notice that I didn't know, there was nothing I could do. It seemed just like this stuff that I could read about, and I did, but I finally felt like, well, this is actually not that much better than Catholicism, which I grew up in. I need something to do. Or so I thought. So fortunately, I was a short drive from sitting groups that Kiroshi had started in Los Altos. So at that point, there was something I could do. And again, that's very much rooted in the body. So the Zen people came up with these, somehow or other, with these stories, Zen stories that can lead the mind in a sort of dizzying circle, with the eventual point, if you like, again, rooted in the body. So even what's called koan study in some circles is rooted in the body. For instance, one of our ancestors, one of our Indian ancestors, Sanghanandi by name, he was sitting zazen with his disciple, Gayashata, and we have this bell in the tree out there, and on this stiff breeze sometimes you'll hear the bell ring. And so they had something like that in their monastery, and so Sanghanandi heard the bell ringing, and he asks Gayashata, he says, is that the wind ringing or the bell ringing? And Gayashata says, that's my mind ringing. And that's my mind sounding the alarm. And hearing that, hearing Gayashata's answer, Sanghanandi says, who is the mind? Not to be tricked, Gayashata replies, because all is silent. And Sanghanandi accepted that. So, in the midst of bells ringing and car alarms, in fact, all is silent. And that silence is rooted in the body. And it may be necessary for us to go through a phase of rejecting such teachings and saying, well, you know, that's ridiculous, and anyway, I don't know what that means, and blah, blah, blah. And then, after a while, we may be able just to, so to say, sit with such teachings and not struggle or reject or grasp or anything. And by and by, the nature of that silence reveals itself. Not so much so that we can then go, oh, there it is. It's not that kind of revealing. Because it's deep in the body. So because all is silent, we can, with a quiet heart, say, let the more loving one be me. And have that reflect our deep vow, our deep intention, that all beings eventually find liberation. And meanwhile, we just go on practicing day by day, just like usual. And that's how the path unfolds. Eventually, we realize that there isn't any path without taking a step. And the path and the stepping are one. So, periodically, we mark our absurd human existence with birthday parties. So we're going to have a little birthday celebration afterwards. Just to assert our Zen heritage and say, absurd? Fine, we don't care. Have some absurd birthday cake. And if you have questions, please ask.
I thought I heard you say someone came up with the Bodhisattva vow.
I may have said that.
Sometimes, doesn't it seem like birds can be awfully noisy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we have a rather insistent mockingbird out there sometimes. But is that a problem? Not really. Okay, I guess you all want to have some birthday cake, so we get to it. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every